I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Five repaired SEPTA regional rail cars are now back in service. WHYY's Tom McDonald traveled to a fabrication plant in Bensalem, Bucks County, to see the work being done to restore normalcy for SEPTA commuters.
A tool called a plasma cutter takes about 6 minutes to carve out one equalizer beam. These will replace the broken and cracked beams that sidelined a third of SEPTA's regional rail fleet and forced the agency to scale back the skeleton schedules. Workers cut 10 beams from a single 4,000-pound sheet of metal. SEPTA General Manager Jeff Knuppel says the beams are different than the ones that cracked, creating this problem.
Before, there was a welded foot attachment at the very end, and the other big issue was that it was notched into the beam. A notch brings more stress to a steel location.
By getting rid of notching and eliminating the weld, Knuppel says a new beam should last 30 years or more. Workers are on the job 12 hours a day and weekends to speed those repairs along. Knuppel says despite that extra effort, there are about 100 more cars to repair, which will take many weeks.
The thing that all of our customers in the region is looking for, okay, you've got five. How long is it going to take to get all of these cars repaired? Right now, the way this graph shows, middle of November.
With the addition of more borrowed and rented trains, Knuppel says SEPTA's working to get back to a full schedule of trains before all the cars are fixed.
That's probably in the very beginning of October. As we mentioned before, I used to say around 10-1. Monday, there's 10-3 or 10-10 are the two Mondays. It's going to be one or the other that we hope right now to be able to return to regular service.
Officials still haven't calculated exactly how much the repairs and train rental will cost. There's also the issue of lost revenue, as some commuters found other ways to work. The cars are still under warranty, so manufacturer Hyundai Rotem will pay much of the expense. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
A Philadelphia inmate who was expecting to die in prison was released today after serving 43 years behind bars. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, Tyrone Jones is one of the first so-called juvenile lifers to gain freedom. This after the U.S. Supreme Court decided that those who were sentenced to life as teenagers deserve new hearings.
It was the first time Tyrone Jones had been on the 28th floor of a building. He had a big meal with family and friends. He even was given a bottle of champagne, but he hadn't opened it yet. Jones is taking his time. He spent four decades in prison, working with his attorneys to get him out.
I had a lot to lose if I would have just gave up. But I didn't give up, you know, because I didn't want to disappoint them. I didn't want to disappoint my family. And most of all, I didn't want to disappoint myself.
Jones remembers the countless times he met with his legal team in prison.
A lot of times when they used to come visit me, they say, oh, we're going one day, you're going to walk out with us. One day you walk out with us. And lo and behold, September 1st, I walked out with him.
Back in 1973, Jones was arrested in connection with a murder in North Philadelphia.
Tyrone, as a 16-year-old boy, was under police interrogation. He was told that he could go home to his mother if he just provided a statement. He provided a statement.
His pro bono attorney, Hayes Hunt, says Jones has always maintained his innocence, though right now his murder conviction remains. Jones was released because of U.S. Supreme Court rulings, not because he was exonerated. While his legal team works on a way to clear his conviction, Hunt says Jones is ready to return to society.
Jobs waiting for him. He has churches waiting for him. He has priests. He has support groups. He has a community college where he can enroll in.
There are nearly 300 other inmates in Philadelphia sentenced to life in prison for murders committed as juveniles who are still awaiting hearings over their possible release. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Cities nationwide are increasingly turning to computer algorithms to predict crimes. Philadelphia is developing its own computer model to help figure out which criminal defendants should get high bail and which should stay free while awaiting trial. But as WHYY's Katie Culinary reports, that tool has sparked a debate about whether big data really does lead to better decisions or just reinforces big bias.
Of the roughly 7,400 people sitting in Philadelphia's jails right now, more than half of them aren't there because they've been found guilty of a crime. They've been accused of one and are waiting for trial. Many of them just can't afford to pay bail. That's what happened to Joshua Glenn. When he was 16, Glenn was arrested and accused of shooting another guy in the arm, a crime he says he didn't commit. Glenn was charged with aggravated assault, but he didn't have $2,000 to bail himself out. He called his mom.
I mean, I just called her to say hi. I knew I was getting out of jail. I knew that they didn't have the money. I mean, I did have friends too, but you got to keep in mind, you're 16. We're all kids. How many kids you know got $2,000?
So Glenn sat in jail for 18 months. Prosecutors eventually dropped Glenn's charges. There wasn't enough evidence to convict him. But by then, he'd paid a heavy price.
You know, I missed a lot of crucial times as a young person in my life just through school. You miss your prom, you miss your graduation, you miss all for something that I had nothing to do with.
Philadelphia's criminal justice system is hoping to prevent this from happening. In the spring, the city announced a $3.5 million foundation grant to help it cut the population in its overcrowded jails. One goal is to decrease the number of people just waiting for trial by 20%. So how do the courts figure out who should be locked up and who should go free? That's where this guy comes in.
I'm Richard Burke. I'm a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
Burke is an applied statistician who specializes in building computer algorithms called risk assessment tools that predict future criminal behavior. How does it work? Burke says it's like going to a bar with friends.
And you're having a beer or two and someone comes up to you and starts talking to you.
You have to decide whether to talk to him or to blow him off.
You have years of experience. You draw on that experience and you say, well, this guy's a jerk. I'm not going to talk with him more. Gee, this guy's kind of nice, kind of interesting. I'm going to encourage the conversation. Computers do the same thing.
Burke gives computers training data about thousands of previous cases to help them learn how to understand new situations.
In the case of the bar scene, should I encourage this conversation or should I not? In the case of criminal justice, should I release this person or should I incarcerate?
Eventually, everyone who's arrested in Philadelphia and goes before a bail commissioner will be run through Burke's risk assessment tool. They'll get a score, putting them into one of three categories: low, medium, or high risk. That score will guide commissioners in deciding whether to set bail and how high to set it based on how likely the defendant is to skip court or commit another crime. Combined with other reforms like creating alternatives to cash bail, the city estimates this plan could free up more than 1,600 jail beds, which could save roughly $30 million in taxpayer dollars. Proponents also say making data-informed decisions will help eliminate bias. But not everyone agrees. Paul Hetznecker is a defense attorney who's been at it for 30 years. He supports all the reforms the city is planning to make, except for this one thing. That's because Hetznecker thinks the data that go into these risk assessment tools are biased.
If you're in a poor neighborhood and racist police have been arresting generations of individuals, how do you take that into account in terms of the risk assessment?
Hetznecker fully agrees the current system of leaving it up to bail commissioners who may have biases of their own is flawed. But he doesn't see how it fixes anything to switch to a system full of data tainted by what he sees as years of biased police tactics. Burke says court officials have asked him to leave out data about race and zip code from Philadelphia's risk assessment tool. He understands why, but insists that factors like where defendants live do have an impact on how risky it is to release them before trial.
There's very little crime where I live in Philadelphia. Maybe there's a lot of crime where you live in Philadelphia. Those are real factors that are associated with crime. If you don't allow us to use those, we're going to be forecasting less accurately. We may be more fair. That's arguable.
Burke says not including zip codes and race would ensure fairness, but make predictions less accurate.
How many aggravated assaults, how many homicides, how many rapes are you prepared to trade for an instrument that's race neutral?
That's the dilemma officials involved in Philadelphia's reform effort have to sort out. Keir Bradford Gray, head of the city's Defenders Association, says the way pretrial decisions are made does need to be improved. But she's also concerned the tool will err on the side of keeping some people in jail while they're presumed innocent.
We want to make sure that what's in these risk assessments are something that we can measure and balance so that it doesn't create an overly biased situation for some. And we want to also make sure that risk assessments aren't the sole piece of information that is used to determine bail.
Bradford Gray wants bail commissioners to take into account more information about defendants' lives, whether they have families and ties to their communities, whether they have addictions or other problems that need to be addressed. The risk assessment tool is supposed to be ready by next spring. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
There's change ahead at the helm in Delaware. A two-term limit spells the end of Democratic incumbent Governor Jack Markell's tenure. U.S. Congressman and former Lieutenant Governor John Carney is running unopposed for the Democratic nomination. Two Republicans are vying to take him on, and we spoke yesterday with Lacey Lafferty. Joining me today in advance of the September 13th Delaware primary election is State Senator Colin Bonini. Colin, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Great. Well, thanks for having me, and really appreciate the time.
And let's add, you are a long-serving state senator, I believe, since the mid-90s. Describe your constituency in Kent County.
My district goes just from just south of Dover. It includes the Dover Air Base down to just north of Milford, Delaware. So Magnolia, Frederica, but mostly unincorporated Kent County.
And why are you abandoning them to seek the governorship?
I certainly hope I'm not abandoning them. I'm certainly hoping I can continue to represent them well as our next governor. But the bottom line is Delaware's in trouble. Our economy is one of the worst in the East Coast, perhaps one of the worst in the country. If you just look at income, we have the lowest income growth in the country. And our labor participation rate is abysmal. Our public schools are in trouble. And of course, violent crime is on the rise in not just our cities, but the state, you know, with Murdertown, USA, and Wilmington, and violence in Dover. The fundamentals are heading in the wrong direction, and Delaware has to change course.
Yet, the number of registered Democrats typically far outweighs those of Republicans. How do you hope to prevail?
So I think people are going to look past just partisanship. Delaware has a long history of folks who are willing to vote for both Republican and Democrats. We had, remember, U.S. Senator Bill Roth and U.S. Senator Joe Biden for decades together. So I think folks are willing to take a look at the other party. Admittedly, Delaware's become basically a one-party state. But things are bad enough, and people are frustrated enough with the way Delaware's being run, that I think they're going to be looking for alternatives, and I think we have a chance.
Your rival, Lacey Lafferty, agrees that things are bad. In fact, she says they're so bad that what's really needed is somebody who hasn't been enmeshed in the system for decades, like Colin Bonini.
Well, she's certainly entitled to that opinion. I think anybody who thinks I'm enmeshed in the system has not spent more than 30 seconds reviewing my record. I have been an agent of change in my tenure in the Senate, and I also think, hopefully I bring actually a good combination of things, both a little bit of a rebel willing to really shake things up, but also have a good sense of how state government works and what the issues are.
Because you've appeared at a rally for Donald Trump, I'd like you to speak a bit about his candidacy, which you apparently support. He is obviously an outsider.
The key takeaway, I think, from the Donald Trump campaign, there's two pieces of this that are critical. One is the message that our government is broken. And I think that's exactly true, and it's particularly true in Delaware, and that we've got to fix it. And the second message, I think, from the Trump campaign is that there is a tremendous disconnect between those who run the government and those who are governed. We have got to close that gap. And I think both of those are very, very legitimate messages. I think both of those messages are very relevant in Delaware, and I actually think those are the messages that both America and Delaware need to hear.
Let's say you get an office in November. Where would you prioritize? What would you do first?
So the first thing is reform our budget so we can free up money. I would look at streamlining state government through an early retirement incentive and significant reform on Medicaid. I would push for right-to-work legislation, which I realize is politically difficult to do but is vitally important. And then I would continue to look at reforming our public schools by bringing decision-making down to the actual school level, not up at the Department of Education or the district level. And then I'd look at bringing, you know, more enforcement into these high-risk communities. I think we need substations. I think we need more police. I think we need to be looking at combining police forces if that's necessary. Bringing safety to those neighborhoods that are unsafe today, it would be a critical priority. And then the other thing I do within the first 90 days is create a commission on how our government works. Because quite frankly, I think Delaware's government, I don't think it's anybody's individual's fault, but just the way things have evolved, our government is tremendously inefficient and quite frankly, ineffective. And I would put together a commission staffed almost exclusively by private sector folks to come in and look at regulatory reform and also how our government is functioning, both from a cost perspective and whether, in fact, it's effectively meeting the needs of the people of Delaware, which I argue it is not currently.
To the extent that polls can be relied upon, apparently it's a close contest. How will you distinguish yourself in the remaining 11 days from your rival?
I think the bottom line is that I have been a proven conservative leader for a long time. And I think people know that if they want to vote for a principled conservative leader in the primary, then I'm that guy, and I'm kindly asking, you know, for their vote. So I think people understand that I'm someone who's willing to take a stand and stir things up a little bit and have a track record of, you know, sticking to my conservative principles.
Colin Bonini, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kent County State Senator Colin Bonini, and you can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Next week, the annual Philadelphia Fringe Festival gets underway, featuring 150 productions over 16 days. Ranging from major international artists to local theater icons to unknown artists in unusual places. Now 20 years old, the Fringe helped establish experimental theater in Philadelphia. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the experimental performance artists who grew up alongside the festival are now training the next vanguard of alternative theater.
The Pig Iron Theater Company started in 1995 at Swarthmore College. That's where the founding members studied. They wanted to establish themselves in a major theater city, so they were looking at Chicago, Minneapolis, New York, and then they heard that a fringe festival was starting in Philadelphia. For that first festival, in 1997, co-founder Quinn Baradell blanketed the Old City neighborhood with posters for a show called Cafeteria.
So we actually hired with pizza a group of like 25 Swarthmore 18, 19 year olds to be our marketing team. And when you're 18 or 19 and told to put posters up anywhere you can find a place to put a poster and hand out these flyers, they just went bananas.
Bordell's co-founder is Dito Van Reigersberg, also known by his stage name, Martha Graham Cracker.
One of our pizza bribed interns made a giant sheet, made a giant bed sheet into a cafeteria poster, and then tried to hang it over the highway and got us into a little bit of trouble.
And somebody postered a moving bus. We didn't pay for the bus poster, which I guess costs a lot of money, but somebody put a poster on a moving bus. So there were posters everywhere.
The success of that first Fringe Festival convinced Pig Iron to put down roots in Philadelphia. The festival and the company have since grown up together, each becoming an institution of experimental theater. The festival has its own building on the Delaware River, and the Pig Iron has a school of advanced performance training. It's a three-year program accredited through the University of the Arts. Pig Iron teaches what is called devised ensemble theater. That's a creative process that does not start with a script to be memorized by performers, but with people on stage figuring out what story they want to tell. It's sort of a bottom-up approach.
That approach just felt so different than other theater schools I had been looking at, which is about how do we train you to be an actor so we can hand you a script and put other people's words in your mouth.
This is Nick Gillette. He's a graduate of the Pig Iron School. He and fellow alumnus Ben Greenberg created their own company called Almanac. It will be in this year's Fringe Festival with a performance, Exile 2588. It's a futuristic tale of Prometheus told with acrobatics and a folk duo, Chickabiddy.
But don't you talk me down, talk me down, talk me down, talk me down.
Gillette, who is trained in martial arts, says he learned from Pig Iron how to make theater through very physical, athletic movement.
What they gave us was the allowance to take the thing that we love and run as hard as we could with it. So the liberty to trust ourselves and our artistic voice is an amazing gift that we got from that theater school.
Can't help but look when it shines just right.
Pig Iron is not the only company training the next generation of experimental artists. Another is Headlong Dance Theater, who also performed at that first Fringe Festival 20 years ago. Co-founder Amy Smith remembers that dance was called Pop Songs.
Pop Songs was a collection of pieces with pop songs and two pop songs. I wonder if I shouldn't mention the specific pop songs because we certainly didn't get permission to use them.
The music Smith used was 1997 indie rock, Galaxy 500, The Violent Femmes, The Blake Babies.
I've got a girl in a box. Keep her under my bed.
When most choreographers reach a certain age, they tend to get teaching jobs at schools, but Smith decided to invent a school, the Headlong Performance Institute. She wanted to teach artists how to survive.
We have a strong focus on creation, but we also, a class that I teach called The Life of the Artist is a really big piece of the curriculum for us because it's all about things like budgeting and taxes and day jobs and fundraising for your work and all the things that aren't taught in colleges and universities but should be.
Tell Mission Control that I'm staying on Mars. I'm not going back.
I'm sorry.
That is not possible.
A graduate of Headlong Dance Institute is Dani Solomon, who will be performing her own show at the Fringe Festival this year, called One Way Red, about starting a colony on Mars.
There's nothing for me back on Earth.
Solomon came to Headlong right after graduating from Colgate University. She had studied both theater and physics and found herself at a divide to pursue science or art. The Headlong School cinched her decision.
Their way of looking at creation is a mode of like asking questions about ourselves, our culture, and the world we live in. And that's what, you know, physics, serious physics inquiry is as well. That's what research is. So I find myself in the rehearsal space starting off with a bunch of questions that I have, in this case about, you know, why we look to other planets to solve our problems here.
This will be Solomon's first show at the Fringe Festival, but she prepared for it by debuting this piece, One Way Red, last year at Philadelphia's Solo Festival, which presents solo performances on a low budget.
Solo Fest is totally like the new Fringe. It's the Fringe of the Fringe.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Vinyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.